You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
Do you enjoy the arts, have an interest in art classes and meeting your local creative community? Then join us at the Athens Cultural Center on the first Friday of each month from 5 to 7 p.m. View our latest exhibition over free nibbles and drinks hosted by our ACC board members and get to know us. We are at 24 2nd Street in Athens and online at athensculturalcenter.org. We look forward to meeting you.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Mary Shea in Burr Ridge, Illinois. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. NBC reports that Representative Elise Stefanik refused to say that she would accept the 2024 election results and refused to criticize former President Donald Trump for his Hitler echo about migrants, and I quote, poisoning the blood, end quote, of America in a Meet the Press interview on January 8th. Stefanik said, and I quote, "We will see if this is a legal and valid election. What we're seeing so far is that Democrats are so desperate, they're trying to remove President Trump from the ballot," end quote. Actually, Republicans, independents, and Democrats have made efforts to remove Trump from the ballot for attempting to overthrow the government with his support of the January 6, 2021 insurrection. The 2020 presidential election was free and fair, and Trump lost over 60 court cases trying to prove otherwise. Stefanik also broke with the police and supported the rioters who ransacked the U.S. Capitol, saying about those who have been jailed for breaking the law, and I quote, "I call them hostages. Some people call them prisoners. I call them hostages. Release the J6 hostages, Joe. Release them, Joe. You can do it real easy, Joe," end quote. Previously, Stefanik has ran for her seat saying she supported the police, not criminals. Previously, Stefanik called January 6, 2021 a, and I quote, "truly tragic day for America," end quote. Stefanik represents Rensselaer County and the rest of the 21st Congressional District. And you can read more about this story at NBC News. Steve Hughes reports in the Times Union that Bethlehem Democrat Joanne Cunningham is the first woman to chair the Albany County Legislature. Since its founding in 1898 as the Albany County Board of Supervisors, no woman has been the leader. Now Cunningham is chair, and Albany Democrat Wanda Willingham is deputy chair. Last year, Cunningham tried to depose former chair Andrew Joyce. That failed, but this year, Willingham had the votes to win the seat. Cunningham said, and I quote, "What I envisioned in the past did not work. The respect was not there. I felt like not only was I being overshadowed, but minimized and stonewalled," end quote. Joyce said, and I quote, "I think I was more focused on the work and the job than I was managing all these multiple personalities, and that was my big mistake," end quote. Cunningham said it is important for women to be in charge sometimes, saying, and I quote, "I do think it's really, really important to celebrate that because women do bring a different leadership style and different leadership skills," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Mid-Hudson News reports that after the winter's first major snowstorm, rain forecasts for January 9th may cause flooding. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for Tuesday and Wednesday ahead of 2 to 4 inches of rain expected throughout the region. The National Weather Service said, and I quote, "Excessive runoff from heavy rainfall and snowmelt may result in flooding of rivers, creeks, streams, and other low-lying and flood-prone locations," end quote. In parts of Ulster County, a foot or more of snow fell over the weekend, with about 8 inches in Dutchess County and more like 6 inches in Greene and Columbia counties. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
The Public News Service Doha Newscast, January the 9th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. Indiana's Governor Eric Holcomb has laid out his top priorities for his last year in office.
During the Republican governor's eighth year leading the state, his biggest push is to expand educational opportunities. Specifically, he hopes to raise awareness of existing resources and ease access to early childhood learning. Holcomb will need lawmakers' help to accomplish some of his ideas. He hopes to improve salaries for early childhood educators, lower the minimum caregiver age for infants and toddlers from 21 to 18 years old, and his 2024 vision focuses on improving reading proficiency and literacy.
So more people can participate in the workforce, and that means more access to programs like On My Way Pre-K and making sure that we're kindergarten ready and the Imagination Library.
Holcomb vows to spend whatever it takes to help children master reading, which he says will widen their prospects and opportunities when they become adults and enter the workforce. I'm Joe Ullery reporting.
Meantime, the Republican Party of Florida ousted its chairman on Monday, more than a month after police in Sarasota confirmed he was under criminal investigation for sexual assault. That from the New York Times. The Times reports in mid-December, the state's party executive committee censured Christian Ziegler and stripped him of his duties and annual salary of $120,000. That after Governor DeSantis, Senator Rick Scott, and some county-level Republican chairs urged him to go. Meantime, within hours before the start of the Florida legislative session, newly filed bills are set to test the limits on hot-button topics such as abortion and free speech.
Florida's new 15-week abortion ban has yet to be implemented due to litigation, but Republican State Representative David Barrero of Sweetwater has filed HB 1519, which prohibits any person or entity from purposely performing or attempting to perform an abortion. Democratic State Representative Anna Eskamani of Orlando took to social media to express her outrage, calling the move cruel for the sake of being cruel.
It is a total abortion ban that eliminates what were already narrow exceptions for rape and incest.
I'm Tramell Gomes.
The bill would also remove bedrock journalistic privileges, particularly the right to keep sources anonymous. Under the measure, statements from anonymous sources would be considered presumptively false, making journalists vulnerable to lawsuits. This is Public News Service. Next to Minnesota, where officials have announced what they call one of the largest wage theft lawsuits in state history. The case involves a dairy operator northwest of the Twin Cities.
On Monday, Attorney General Keith Ellison detailed the civil suit against Evergreen Acres Dairy in Stearns County. His office estimates that Evergreen owes its employees at least $3 million in unpaid wages. The state says most of those affected are migrant workers who are also subject to substandard living conditions and on-site housing. Ellison says these workers showed a lot of bravery in sharing their experiences.
You know, this is an employer who's not only paying their wages, but also their landlord all at the same time. So they were concerned.
The suit accuses Evergreen of exploiting vulnerable individuals who are forced to work demanding 12-hour shifts at least 6 days a week. In addition to seeking restitution, Ellison's office is pursuing civil penalties and for the company to end the practices it's accused of. Management officials with Evergreen Acres did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Mike Moen.
And nationwide, cases of COVID, influenza, and RSV are on the rise, but health experts say Ohio lags when it comes to the number of residents vaccinated for protection against respiratory viruses.
Ohio Department of Health Director Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff says around 1.1 million Ohioans have received the updated COVID vaccine that became available last year and doesn't require any boosters. That's a tiny percentage of the state's population. He hopes seniors and other vulnerable populations take time in the new year to stay healthy by getting vaccinated.
Case numbers are rising, and we know that as they do, we will see more hospitalizations and severe illness. Many Ohioans have taken the opportunity to get vaccinated, but many more haven't.
According to the CDC, the number of hospitalizations for COVID nationwide jumped by 20% after the holidays. And emergency rooms also saw an increase in the number of people with severe flu cases. Nadia Ramlagan reporting.
Finally, from our Denver Van Fleet and Omaha Maya organization received one of five $15,000 grants from the nonprofit Green Latinos.
Comunidad Maya Pishan Isim, or CMPI, is an Omaha-based nonprofit supporting Maya and other indigenous communities in Nebraska. Lola Marina Juan Tomas is interim executive director of CMPI. She says there are approximately 10,000 Maya in Nebraska. She says the grant will support the Maya Regeneration Project. CMPI also helps Maya entrepreneurs.
CMPI is honored to represent the Maya community in Nebraska and throughout the heartland as a lead organization for that.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member listener supported. You can hear us at radio stations big and small, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. With narrow margins between Republican and Democratic voters in Wisconsin, both parties are fighting for every inch of ground before the state's 2024 election, upon which both the presidency and the control of the U.S. House may hinge. January 2nd, a lower court struck down the use of minor errors on mail-in ballots to disqualify voters. Democracy Docket reports that Wisconsin's mail-in ballots require a witness signature and address, and minor errors in the witness information on otherwise qualified ballots were causing the whole ballot to be discarded, due in part to a lack of guidance from the state. In 2016, the Wisconsin Election Commission had issued the guidance, allowing clerks to fill in minor witness address information on otherwise qualified ballots, but Republicans sued to strike down the guidance. Also brewing is a challenge to a recent Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling striking down Wisconsin's gerrymandered legislative redistricting maps. The Wisconsin Examiner reports that the court ordered new maps, supervised by a special master, by January 12th. After earlier threatening impeachment of Justice Janet Prusiewicz, state GOP leaders have asked for reconsideration of the case, arguing Prusiewicz should have recused herself for comments about gerrymandering she made during the campaign. They've also threatened to take the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. See more on the roller coaster year ahead in Wisconsin at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hello and welcome to the Danger Zone. I mean the better weather for Tuesday, January 9th. Local early morning temperatures range from 14 degrees in Steventown to 25 in Tannersville and Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 35 degrees. A rich palette of weather's awesomeness will be on display today across our region. Wind and flood warnings are out. Check those sub pumps, fill those generators, charge your devices, and make sure you have plenty of snacks as today gets interesting around noon. You are going to want to avoid travel today if you can, folks. A frozen morning sees what looks like at first snowfall after 10 a.m. Temperatures steadily rise, reaching 36 by dark. By then, it should be all rain. If that all happens to start as rain or a mix instead of snow, that means icing could occur suddenly. If you are, let's say, brave enough to head outside, plan extra travel time, and I hope your tires are in really good condition. In the higher elevations, you can expect something similar. Plan for delays and a couple inches of nasty wet snow piling up for a couple hours after dark. Overnight, for everyone, it gets very windy and very rainy. Temperatures reach 50 degrees, and this is when the warnings are really in effect. Set that cell alarm and expect to wake up to blinking alarm clocks. Tomorrow morning, check traffic routes as places could be flooded out. Frozen ground and rainfall do not mix well. Winds calm down and rain tapers off by dark temperatures level off around 45 degrees. Overnight, it should be dry and see a low of 32. Thursday is looking dry with a high of 40. Friday, looking the same, dry with a high of 40 degrees. Sunset today will be at 4:27 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:19 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be slow at 398 kilometers per second with a thin density of 4 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair below 60 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 152, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
Big difference between being comfortable and being happy. Comfortable can be miserable.
From his 2020 album Narrations, that was Wesley Harper from Catskill with Comfortable Can Be Miserable. This is Brendan Donegan with the Ag Report for WGXC 90.7 FM. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Columbia and Greene counties produce over $100 million of agricultural goods a year. The Ag Report looks behind the stats to highlight the people and issues involved in Twin Counties food production. Brendan Donegan interviews local artisanal and mid-scale providers of crops, wool, dairy, fish, and timber, and those at our cooperative extension, chambers of commerce, and tourist board offices who help market our agricultural products. Today I'm in the village of Catskill overlooking Catskill Creek with Tim Graham and Anna Rosenkrantz of Left Bank Ciders. What's the story of LBC?
Well, we started making cider after working at the farmers market in Greenpoint,
yeah,
New York, and
2015 or so.
That's in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the backstory is that we were collecting scrap junk apples that were destined for the compost because Anna was working for
Grow NYC, like the local compost program.
Mm-hmm.
And we just collected so many apples that were mostly good, but just not perfect enough to be sold at the market to customers who want perfectly round, ripe, red apples.
Mm-hmm.
So we just felt sad for all these apples, and we started taking them home, and we were cooking with them and making things with them.
Yeah,
and
they were highly usable.
They were highly usable.
So
and
we didn't want them to go to the...
Yeah.
They weren't going to the trash,
no.
Trash necessarily, but they were going to the compost.
The compost, so. But we thought they were too good for the compost.
Yeah.
And then we made just a lot of apple cakes and things like that, and we were like, what else can we do with these? So.
Yeah.
We started making cider in a very, very low, professional way.
Yeah.
We were using a food processor and a t-shirt.
Where does the process of making cider start? I mean, it starts with the apples. You got a bushel basket of apples. Where do they go? What do you do with them?
Well, for us, it starts before we even have our hands on a bushel of apples, because what we love to do, what we're really passionate about doing, I mean, we collect apples in a variety of ways, but our passion is collecting wild apples and apples that are growing, tended by the land, essentially. And we spend a lot of our time in late summer, early fall, through late fall, till the first snowfall,
yeah.
Collecting wild apples in the Catskills. That's what we love to do. And a lot of our ciders are wild apple, wild foraged, wild fermented.
How do they differ from cider apples that are sold commercially?
Well, like Anna mentioned, there are many different types of apples. And most of the apples that you'll get at a You Pick Orchard or from the market or anything like that are just for eating apples.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually called like culinary or dessert fruit.
Yeah.
And then there are some cider specific apples that we kind of describe as are like wine grapes. Like you wouldn't really want to eat wine grapes necessarily. They're not for that.
Yeah. They're super bitter, or they're really sour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they or they have a texture great. That is really unpalatable.
Yeah.
How do they look?
They look gnarly. They can they have scabs. They
gnarly apples.
They are bumpy.
Yeah, they might.
I mean, they can.
So
they're beautiful. Yeah. They can be extraordinarily beautiful, multicolored, striped. They come in. They really run the gamut, and they can also be very traditional apple.
Look, mm-hmm.
They're usually smaller than an apple that you would buy at a farm stand.
So you go out with a sack and you come back here with your apples.
We use IKEA bags.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they're very sturdy. They're very large.
When you get the apples back here, what do you do? What are the steps you use to do this?
So a lot of times we'll do what's called sweating. So we'll just leave the apples to sit for a period of time, mm-hmm. and they will evaporate some of their moisture and water content.
How long would that be?
Well, a lot of our schedule just depends on how many days we're out in the field versus pressing. So it's more aligned with our schedule than it is like any specific length of
mm-hmm.
time. But all the apples are going to usually like sit for a little bit, which is sweating, until we get a volume of apples that we can press, because we don't want to do a small volume. We want to do like a larger
volume. How many bushels would that be?
Let's see, 20 bushels goes into a bin, and we want to do at least 4 bins at a time, so that's 80, but preferably 100 to 200 at a time would make sense. So, yeah, we collect the apples. They're sweating while we get the right volume. And then the difference between making wine with grapes and making cider is we have to grind the apples into a pulp as opposed to, like, just putting grapes in a press or foot stomping them or something. So there's an intermediary step where we grind the apples because you can't just press whole apples. So there's the grinding process, and then you have the pomace is what it's called. And then you press that, and that gives you the juice.
So how many varieties or how many styles of cider do you serve or do you offer? Oh, my.
Yeah. I'm pointing to our bottle shop.
Yes. I'm looking at a wall of bottles.
Yeah, we make a lot. We have a lot of fun because we're doing a lot of small batches. We don't make very many large batches of anything. Because, say, we're up in the mountains and we find one really great tree or several great trees or we're in one area of the mountains, we want to capture the essence of Wyndham or Tannersville. So we will make and produce a cider and then bottle that so small batches to reflect
Do you call them Wyndham? Do you call them Tannersville?
On the labels, we'll explain where the apples are from.
Yeah, we will name them after people who gave us access to their apples, too. We have an orchard at a friend of ours named Byron, and he has a really nice little hobby orchard.
So he gets his own cider.
So there's a Byron, there's a Tina, there's another landowner with, like, some very special cider apple trees. There's Steve, who's another hobby orchard. Steve.
There's a Jackie.
Yeah. So
you have a Steve. You have a bottle of Steve.
It's called Madman Steve.
Madman Steve. Okay.
We asked his permission before we called it that, but he is a madman.
How has the response been to these varieties that you serve? Do people come in and say, you got some Steve?
Sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are looking for specific things.
I mean, I think it's very... I think we try to strike a balance between... having enough variety that there's something for mostly everyone, not everyone. But
yeah, everything is dry, so we don't really make any sweet cider. So
How do the alcohol levels differ from batch to batch?
They're actually pretty consistent from batch to batch, which is really nice. The wild cider will get quite high in alcohol content.
How high would that be? ABV, as they say.
We're a farm cider, and we're really not legally allowed to make cider above 8.5%.
Okay.
So we keep everything below that because that's the law for us. But cider, usually it's all within the 7 to 8% alcohol range. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, we tell people, it's like a very strong beer, but less alcoholic than wine. So it's a nice sweet spot between the kind of beer and wine space.
What outlets have you found to market your product?
We mostly do direct to consumer.
We're lucky. We have this big tap room. When we first opened, it was July of 2020, so it was pretty pandemic.
I remember going by and thinking they're brave.
We really had no
brave
choice. We had
stupid.
Been preparing the space for almost 2 years. You know, like we were ready, and one thing we did was we were not planning on having a patio, so we pivoted and laid cement down and put up a patio because we knew that that was going to be like the space to be, the safe space to be. We have this space, and our goal was always to have this be like the place where people would come rather than us having to wholesale. And
yeah, the main point of sale would be here. So
what are your hours?
Plan. Right now we are Wednesday through Sunday, and on the weekdays we're 4 to 10, and on the weekend we're 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And we have food and a lot of pop-ups.
Yeah, we
events.
Have pizza every Saturday. We have food Fridays and Thursdays. And
How has your experience with the farmers market in Hudson been?
Oh, great.
Great, we love it.
Yeah, it's great. It's, I mean, for us, we got our start at a farmers market. So it's kind of like...
Very comfortable.
Very comfortable, familiar. Farmers markets are just like... I don't know, good they feel community. Like super sweet communities, and mm-hmm. we bring our kid who runs around, and there are lots of other kids there, and you see the same people every week, and it's a lovely place.
Do you do any other farmers markets or just Hudson?
We do, yeah.
Yeah, we do. We pop up at Saugerties, Kinderhook. We've done a couple others.
Yeah, we do others as well.
But Hudson right now is our like consistent mm-hmm. every week.
That's on Saturdays.
Yes.
Yeah, Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
Tell us about Apple Camp.
Well, I just got back from New York Apple Camp, which...
it's a ragtag team of Apple nerds and enthusiasts.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's a spinoff where they started it in Maine, and the Maine Organic Farmers Association put it together for its first few iterations, and now they're doing one in New York.
So what do you do there?
Oh, you just go, and there's some really great presentations about apples and a lot of apple cider makers and nursery people and orchardists and stuff all gather, and we just see what's going on in apple world.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
There's also like
Cider Days in Franklin County. That's mm-hmm. a big thing.
There's a loose affiliation now of like Hudson Valley Cider Makers, which is just getting off the ground, which is nice because cider making... it's not new to the Hudson Valley, but it's like new as sort of like there's not been like an organized group of cider makers in the way that they're sort of coalescing now.
So you're not apple hermits.
No.
I mean, you do get around and you meet other apple enthusiasts.
Oh, yeah.
Cider enthusiasts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. What advice would you give to people thinking about an ag-based business in this region?
I think I would give advice, try to do direct to consumer as much as possible. It's mm-hmm. very hard to find markets. It can be really difficult to get into farmers markets. There's waiting lists. And
so when you say direct to consumer, you're saying not farmers markets, but you're
I mean, that is a form of direct to consumer. But
what other ways are there?
Wholesale. Like wholesale for us is sort of like a side hustle.
Yeah.
That is, it's a tough business, like getting into retail stores and restaurants and things like that.
How about advertising?
I mean, we don't do much advertising outside of Instagram, and we have a newsletter.
Yeah,
all right. Well,
yeah, I just
think, we're not opposed. We just haven't really explored that.
Yeah, I guess if you can find a way to sell your things to people directly, however that fits.
To cut out the middleman.
That's the best way.
Yeah.
What do you think, Anna? You think there's other ways?
I mean, the other ways people do are, wholesaling and things like that. But, I mean, for us, we're really rooted in this community. We're both a bar and also a destination for people who are, like, tourists who are looking for things to do. Mm-hmm. And that model has worked out for us, as opposed to trying to get into as many markets as possible. Mm-hmm. Markets being bars, restaurants, wine shops, things like that, because there's a lot of legwork involved in that.
Yeah.
And you'd make less money.
Yeah, what Anna said was a really good point. Like, root yourself in a community.
Yes.
And really be a part of that mm-hmm. community, and they will support you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So know your surroundings.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was really important for us not just to have this business here, but to live in this community. We live on Main Street. Our partner lives on Main Street. Like, we're here. We're part of this community. We host
soup
events.
Soup night.
Soup nights.
Soup night.
We do lots of community events, and I think our community recognizes that. And
we were able to give a lot of money back to the community this year because all of the soup night donations just go directly to organizations that people pick, and we gave over $4,000 back through that process, which is really great.
So, finally, what foods go well with cider?
Well, the classic one is cheese, and that really does work very well.
I think cider, a dry cider, goes really well with spicy food.
Okay.
Indian food?
Indian food, yeah, totally. Yeah. I wish we had more Indian food at our disposal up here, but...
Yeah. I mean, we have a cider. I guess we could kind of think about our list and say we have a cider for almost every food. We have peach cider and currant cider, and then we have the wild ciders, and then just classic dry ciders.
Yeah, something with more body, like our currant cider, would go really well with, like, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of drinks like a red wine almost.
Yeah,
could go
so
really
you
well
could
with
do
meat,
meats
pork.
And
um,
and what foods do you sell here? to go with the ciders? Do you have cheese?
That's a great question. No, it's on our agenda, but it's been on our agenda for 3 years. Let's see. On Thursday nights, we host a farmer's market.
We have pizza.
And we have pizza. Okay. By a pizza maker who goes by X Circles X. Mm-hmm. Very well known in the area. Great pizza.
Yeah.
On Friday nights, we have Mermaid Cafe, a beloved former restaurant in town who closed and now does a pop-up and does like her foraged food bowls on Friday nights, and they're amazing. Saturdays, we have X Circles X Pizza again all afternoon into the evening. And Sunday, we have pop-ups, which is most often a Berkshire...
Grilled lamb.
Grilled. They do grilled meats and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. And where are you located exactly?
We're located on 150 Water Street in Catskill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Brendan Donegan with the Ag Report for WGXC 90.7 FM.
The Community Soup Night returns to Left Bank Ciders in Catskills this coming Thursday. And this coming Thursday, the Soup Night benefits WGXC. Turn out Thursday between 5 and 7 p.m. for the Community Soup Night. At Left Bank Ciders, there'll be at least one vegetarian soup and several different flavors of soup and all kinds of flavors of cider. Tom DiPietro and Cella Graham will be broadcasting live on WGXC Afternoon Show, and DJ Yeshi will also be playing music, too. Turn out this Thursday between 5 and 7 p.m. for Community Soup Night at Left Bank Ciders in Catskill.
Hello, and welcome to Food Segment on WGXC, where I investigate food places and tell you all about my discoveries. As winter descended over the WGXC broadcast area, I started to experience malaise. Without the energy required to dine out, I decided to change course and stock up on food to eat at home. So I picked up two grocery shopping companions and headed to the Hawthorne Valley Farm Store at 327 County Route 21C in Ghent, New York. The Hawthorne Valley Farm Store is part of the Hawthorne Valley Association.
Anthroposophy,
a group of institutions operated by anthroposophists, or people who follow the social and agrarian ideology of Rudolf Steiner.
Anthroposophists.
This was discussed as we drove past the affiliated Waldorf School and into the farm store parking lot. Inside, we pass through the produce section.
While I smell the pizza.
With an array of gourds and other seasonal produce.
Produce looks gorgeous, though.
Yeah. Oh, coconut milk. There's a sale, actually.
I found an auspicious stack of coconut milk on sale and placed many cans of it in my cart. My shopping companions and I looked at an array of maple syrup and honey.
From Ghent, so it's local.
Local honey, always good, right?
Before moving on to the nut butter dispensers.
Fresh peanut butter.
Fresh peanut butter. Pretty impressive. They've got honey roasted, salted, unsalted, hazelnuts, almonds.
There are several nut butter machines, which are clear, so that you can see the nuts inside.
Some of the nuts, like the honey roasted, seem to be like covered in sugar. And then it grinds in a machine, so that when it comes out as butter.
Each one contains a different type or flavor of nut, which it grinds into nut butter and dispenses for the customer. A majority of the products sold at the Hawthorne Valley Farm Store are either produced locally or produced by the Hawthorne Valley brand, which has its own bakery, creamery, and line of fermented products. One full aisle is dedicated to vitamins, and generally, it has the feel of a health food store or a co-op. In a corner, next to the nut butter, we found a self-serve kombucha tap.
What turns people off from kombucha is that it can feel like really heavy and pungent when you like get that sip in.
With various flavors of Aqua Vitae brand kombucha.
Wait, the peach is absolutely, it tastes exactly like a peach.
And small paper cups for sampling.
It's like bringing me back to like kind of like...
Pineapple can really brighten up.
Brighten and tighten.
I zigzagged across three aisles to the boxed cereal section to pick out a bag of Michelle's granola, spelled with one L, which has a crumbly texture and tastes vanilla-y. Past bulk bins of beans and other dried pantry items, we came to the dairy section, where I picked out a half gallon of Highlawn Farm whole milk from New Jersey. My shopping companions inspected the prepared foods, which we plan to consume after checking out.
They have chicken marbella, sesame orange tofu, mashed sweet potatoes, and sauteed broccolini.
I got pizza.
I lived upstate for so long, like, I don't do pizza up here.
Which is served on round metal trays inside of a warming container.
So, yeah, it's reminding me of, like, Chuck E. Cheese, and that's what I want right now.
And two chunks of chicken thighs under a label that read, Chicken Marbella.
The chicken marbella has arrived.
What's marbella? Oh, there's capers.
And contained capers and olives. My shopping companions also got chicken.
Okay, Rich is going for the fried tofu.
As well as fried tofu, sauteed broccolini,
and turkey noodle.
Turkey noodle.
And a beef barley.
And a beef and barley soup. On the other side of the hot prepared foods,
kale and beet salad,
there were cold prepared items,
roasted Brussels sprouts,
like kale Caesar salad,
and cranberry ginger chutney.
In a separate refrigerated shelf, closer to the checkout line, there are other cold prepared items that are pre-wrapped, like noodles, sandwiches, and overnight oats.
I love, like, I don't know why, but I just love, this reminds me of, like, my first days working. Like, I would always eat, like, packaged sandwiches like this.
My shopping companion examined a hummus sandwich, which brought back childhood memories. The items in our cart included chocolate-covered almonds, Hawthorne Valley Farm Store brand Fig Newton adjacent cookies.
I got your cookies. Don't you worry.
Yuzu ginger flavored seltzer. Curry chicken salad.
Okay, Shanika's getting a rotisserie chicken.
Michelle's granola. Two types of milk. Maple syrup.
Purple sweet potatoes. I'm making sweet potato pie.
Purple sweet potatoes. And our prepared food. My pizza slice fell over onto the conveyor belt at checkout. So that the crust was touching it as it traveled towards the register.
My pizza has basically touched like every surface of this store.
I asked the person ringing me up where the bakery was located.
Here, actually, if you want to talk to the gentleman right here about what you're requesting.
And he directed me to someone else.
Is it here?
Yeah, it is.
Who answered that the Hudson Valley Bakery, which supplies the store with bread and pastries, was just behind some swinging doors beyond the produce section. I found my shopping companion sitting at a table outside. They were already finished eating.
So the pizza is...
It's just simple.
No, like the flat crust.
I tried the part of my pizza that hadn't touched the conveyor belt.
The tomato sauce is like pink, as though maybe they like mix it with cheese or something. And
the chicken marbella.
Is it like cooked in wine or something?
Yeah.
Which was juicy and tangy in a savory wine sauce. I tasted the tofu.
I'm enjoying the sesame tofu, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not a big tofu person, but I thought I'd get a few.
What's the texture like?
Firm.
Mm-hmm. It's like kind of like dense. Firm.
Which had gotten cold.
Very subtle orange.
And had a hint.
Is there like a sauce or like the oranges?
Of orange glaze.
Just.
Like a little orange sauce.
What about the broccoli?
No, totally. It's like perfectly cooked. Covered in garlic, which we love.
Anything that we didn't eat got composted. Thank you for listening to this edition of Food Segment on WGXC.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
New York Renews is a coalition of over 370 environmental justice, faith, labor, and community groups, and was a lead group in enacting the CLCPA, the state's new climate law. They held a virtual climate state of the state press conference on Monday, January 8th, to discuss their climate justice priorities for 2024, the People's Climate Justice Budget, and Climate Jobs and Justice Package. Key themes included making climate polluters pay to clean up the damages they have caused, an immediate $1 billion investment in shovel-ready climate projects, and the need for faster action from the state. Key bills included the New York Heat and Climate Superfunds Act. In part one of our two-part coverage, we hear from Catherine Nadeau of Catskill Mountain Keeper, Assemblymembers Pat Fahey and Jeff Jenowitz, and State Senator Liz Krueger.
My name is Catherine Nadeau, and I'm the Deputy Director for Catskill Mountain Keeper. I'm also a steering committee member over at New York Renews. So we're here together because over the past year, the climate crisis has only intensified. We are seeing example after example of human suffering as a result of a quickly warming planet. Last winter, nearly 50 people died in Western New York, most of them in Buffalo, after a historic blizzard. The state was blanketed in toxic wildfire smoke several times this summer, leading to skyrocketing increases in hospital visits for asthma and other chronic conditions. We saw record-breaking heat throughout the summer. And in September, we saw New York City hit with a month's worth of rain in only 3 hours. It flooded basements, schools, subways, and cars. And while New Yorkers are busy dealing with the incredibly expensive, immediate, life-changing, and at times fatal impacts from the climate crisis, massive corporations are pulling in record profits from deadly fossil fuels. They're profiting from New Yorkers' suffering. And that's where our coalition comes in. New York Renews is made up of frontline communities, and we have a vision, a climate-stable world with clean air and green jobs. And all of this is in reach, and it's common sense. So this year, looking at the legislative session, our communities came together, and we put together a list of the projects that we know we can get committed and off the ground in 2024 with a $1 billion investment. And we're calling this the People's Climate Justice Budget. This $1 billion investment, it would be a down payment on the $10 to $15 billion a year that NYSERDA has already identified New York will have to spend every year to address the climate crisis at scale. We know state bureaucracy being what it is, it's difficult to go from moderate spending to a $10 billion spend each year. And so that's why we need to start this year by building up and scaling up our systems and our programs to invest in our communities, especially the communities that need it most. So this money would be invested in making energy bills more affordable, especially for low-income and moderate-income New Yorkers, updating our energy grid, shoring up our coastal regions, making our homes safer, and improving the roads and public transportation that are vulnerable to rising seas and worsening storms. And with this $1 billion, our communities could start to see the benefits this year, concretely, in their homes and in their communities. And so that's why we're calling on Governor Hochul to pass the People's Climate Justice and her executive budget and to support the whole climate jobs and justice package. We'll send it over to the Assembly now with Assemblymember Pat Fahey.
The bill that I do carry with Senator Krueger, and that is the HEAT Act. Here in the Assembly, we know we have a lot of work to do, but of course, the momentum and the nightmarish climate that we look at is only getting worse. As Senator Harkin just described, we have seen these extreme weather patterns everywhere throughout the country, let alone throughout New York State. We know just in the last decade or so, it has cost the state $500 billion in climate-related damages. It's not sustainable. This is just not sustainable. I am so proud that we have 75 co-sponsors now in the Assembly of the HEAT Act. And of course, it's already passed the Senate, as we could say, on a few hundred bills. So we know we've got our work to do. But we also know the importance of this, since one third of our greenhouse gas emissions are coming from our building stock. We'll work again. The state of the state is tomorrow. Budget launches in a week or so from now. And the 100-foot rule of saving New Yorkers at least a couple of hundred million, we believe, and breaking this connection, if you will, of where the PSC is indirectly promoting gas systems expansions because of the way the law has been written decades ago. So we've got to break that connection. We've got to give the PSC, or the Public Service Commission, the authority to start the planning, as well as to help address low and moderate income customers who we don't want bearing an undue cost as we move away from fossil fuels. And again, this is not just New York. The UN yet again has come out and said we are moving past this very critical threshold of 1.5% in global temperature changes within this next decade. So the time is very much now.
Thank you so much, Assemblymember. Wait to start these investments and start saving New Yorkers the more expensive it gets every single day. So with that, we're going to turn it over now to Assemblymember Dinowitz, the lead sponsor in the Assembly on the Climate Superfund bill, another of the Climate Jobs and Justice package.
I have four grandsons, age 8, 8, 6, and 5. We refer to this as climate change. To them, it's climate. This is what they've lived with all of their lives now. Think about that. It's going to be worse and worse as time goes on for them. But this is what's been going on for their entire lives. So we have to take action. There are a number of bills in this package which will have a significant impact in starting to do the job that we have to do, counteract climate change and to deal with its impact. The bill that I sponsor with Senator Krueger is the Climate Change Superfund Act. And this legislation will raise at least $75 billion, $3 billion a year over a period of 25 years, which sounds like a lot of money. Actually, it's not nearly as much as we need, but it'll start to make a dent. And it'll do it not by raising taxes, not by costing average people more money, but by essentially assessing the fossil fuel companies that have caused the most damage. And that's something we need to do. This bill, which we hope the governor will put into the budget, makes so much sense on every possible level. And I guess the bottom line is what we keep saying: if you make a mess, as our mothers told us, clean it up. And we know who made the mess. The oil companies, by and large, made much of this mess. And with their record profits, they could afford to kick in a little bit to deal with this. So I think this year we need to be bold. We need to be innovative. We have to deal with this now. And I urge Governor Hochul to put this and other pieces of this package into the executive budget, which is going to be announced shortly.
And we're going to turn now to a great champion in the Senate, Senator Liz Krueger, who's sponsoring a couple of the climate jobs and justice bills and is always a climate champion. So turn it over to Senator Liz.
There really is a growing number of legislators in both houses who understand these complicated issues and are committed to getting things done. So yes, I'm very proud to be working on the New York HEAT Act with Pat Fahey, who already talked a little bit about it. It's a win-win. We can get this done. It saves money for ratepayers, and it decreases a waste of investment in a form of energy that we've already said we are outlawing the use of by X year. So we should not be investing more money in our gas pipe structure. And so that's what the New York HEAT Act does. It stops a ridiculous law that's still on the books that anytime you build anything, you have to add gas infrastructure. Why? We're not going to be using gas. And we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year on it that could be in the ratepayers' pockets. So I'm committed to getting this done in both houses this year. And then I've got the climate change bill, the Superfund climate change bill that Jeff Dinowitz already explained so well. And again, it would bring in money from the exact companies who are causing a huge percentage of the damage. If they don't pay a part of it, we pay all of it. So the guys who did the damage should be picking up at least part of the tab. I unfortunately lost a fight for a veto. I got the veto from the governor on my deforestation bill.
This has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.